Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm Lucas Rappel, and today I'll be speaking with Eugenia Lean. Eugenia is a professor of history, as well as East Asian languages and cultures at Columbia University, and she has just published a new book on science and capitalism during the early 20th century, entitled Vernacular Industrialism in China, Local Innovation and Translated Technologies in the Making of a Cosmetics Empire. Framed as a biography of the maverick entrepreneur Chen Jiaxin, this book provides what Lean provocatively describes as a global microhistory of vernacular industrialism, that is, the pursuit of industry and science outside of conventional venues. This kind of knowledge work, as Lean calls it, often involves tinkering with existing manufacturing practices and creatively appropriating industrial know-how from abroad in an effort to produce innovative new products that could be marketed as authentically Chinese. In this way, vernacular industrialists like Chen Jiaxin helped to presage the sorts of practices that fueled China's economic ascent into the 21st century. Rather than rehash conventional narratives that depict early 20th century China as a moribund society defeated by decades of Western imperialism, or as a rogue state with the habit of infringing on the moral economy of global capitalism by routinely stealing the intellectual property of more technologically advanced nations, instead, Lean offers a refreshing account that puts Chinese culture and vernacular knowledge production at the center of industrial change. This is a wonderful book. Aside from its innovative argument and refreshing historiographical frame, it's beautifully written and deeply researched. I was especially charmed by the main character around which Lean has decided to organize her narrative, Chen Jiaxin. Chen was a truly beguiling, multifaceted human being. Besides building an industrial empire that specialized in his famous butterfly brand of cosmetics, Chen also engaged in the field of cultural production, editing numerous journals and magazines. In addition, he was a widely read poet and author of what Lean describes as sappy romance novels, melodramatic love stories that were popularly known as Mandarin Ducks and Butterfly fictions. Moreover, Lean shows how Chen Jiaxin employed many of the same practices in both his literary and industrial pursuits, practices that revolved around the creative appropriation and playful tinkering with existing formula to create something new. In other words, Lean makes it easy for readers to fall under Chen Jiaxin's spell, much as they did while reading his sappy romances over a century ago. I cannot recommend this book highly enough. Welcome, Eugenia, to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society.
Thank you for having me, Lucas.
Yeah, of course. So congratulations on the quite recent, I think, publication of Vernacular Industrialism in China. It's a really wonderful book. And I wanted to start by asking you about its main character. So the book is structured as a bit of a biography, and it centers on this really interesting, multifaceted figure, Chen Jiaxin. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about who he was, what time he lived in, and why you became so interested in him.
Yeah, Chen Jiaxin, is a fascinating figure. He is the main subject of my book. He lived in the late 19th century into the early 20th century in China, so during the turn of the 20th century. He was a maverick figure in multiple ways. He was an entrepreneur who made money both in the world of letters and in the world of industry and commerce. So, for example, he's most well known as a romance novelist. He wrote these very, very sappy, melodramatic novels that were serialized in urban newspapers at the time. So he was a pen for hire. But he was also prolific as an editor and a translator. He wrote plays, poems, and so he was a multifaceted cultural figure. But in addition to his accomplishments in the world of letters, he was also emerged as a man of commerce and industry. He actually started off as an amateur tinkerer who dabbled in chemistry. He turned his home studio into a chemical lab. As a result of a lot of that tinkering, he started to develop products for commercial manufacturing, and he eventually became a captain of industry. He founded a company known as the Association for Household Industries, which was a cosmetics company. And his most famous product was this tooth powder that you could apply to your face as face powder as well. It was known as the Butterfly brand tooth powder. And one of the reasons why I find him so incredibly fascinating was that he represented a whole generation of educated men and women who lived during a period when China was facing decline politically. This was a period when the Qing Empire collapsed. And in 1911, a new republic was founded. The new republic, however, was very, very weak. And it was seen as quite transitional. A failed experiment in republicanism. While politics was quite fraught, the economic realm in China was actually developing. And this was in part because of new treaty ports that were emerging during this period when Western powers, imperialist powers, and Japan were all trying to sort of develop their industries in China. And so Chinese men and women actually had newfound opportunities in these treaty ports. And he was one of these people who started to take advantage of those opportunities, even as China was facing political challenges. As an individual, he was quite prolific. He was prolific both in writing and in making things. But I really see him as representative of an entire generation that took advantage of this period. And why I find him interesting is that he lets us explore a concept that I call vernacular industrialism, which is the core concept or idea that I am pursuing in this book, and it's obviously also front and center in my title.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by this phrase, vernacular industrialism?
Yeah, so vernacular industrialism, I use this term to kind of describe some of Chen Diexian's activities in the industrial world. And precisely because he was an unexpected participant in the making of Chinese industry, I wanted to capture the array of activities that he engaged in order to manufacture things. Traditionally, sort of figures like Chen, who are known for their lettered work, have been dismissed by historians as being examples of sort of the literatus class in China that was unable to engage in science and commerce. But with Chen's story, I found that this fellow who was classically educated, who wrote poetry, who fit all of the kind of traditional ways of being an elite man, he was actually really able to navigate this transitional period and move from this period where sort of textual work was privileged to the modern period where industrial commercial work became increasingly available to men and women like him. And as he navigated this period, he you know, sort of engaged in activities that one would not expect a typical industrialist to engage in, right? So some of this might be some of the sort of writings that he did about industry. He published a tremendous amount of how-to articles. He circulated recipes that he had translated abroad for fellow readers to peruse and actually draw information and knowledge from. He dabbled and tinkered, not in any kind of formal setting. He oftentimes did this in his, you know, among his lettered peers for fun. But I wanted to take those kinds of activities, which people in the past have often dismissed as frivolous, seriously, and think about how these activities were actually part and parcel of Chen's endeavors that became the basis of his industrial activities. And so the vernacular, the notion of vernacular industrialism is to kind of capture sort of the ad hoc nature of some of the practices, manufacturing practices that he engaged in. Another aspect about vernacular that I really like is that it captures the nativist inclination of Chen as an individual. He was eventually a leader of something known as a national products movement, which was a buy and manufacture Chinese movement that emerged during this period of when China was faced with economic imperialism. And in this political and economic context, nativist industry was deemed extremely important for China to survive. And entrepreneurial individuals like Chen and other merchants sort of mobilized a native products movement, this native products movement, in order to promote Chinese industry. So what I like about this vernacular industrialism is that Chen really mobilized practices that we, from a modern perspective, might consider quite rogue or unacceptable as aspects of formal industry, including kind of copying foreign technology, spending time sort of writing about foreign technology and sharing brand recipes to a large readership, right? This was actually very, very crucial for Chen to spread knowledge, to spread technological knowledge, which he actually called common knowledge in Chinese, Changshi. And he thought that this was actually very virtuous. This was hardly unethical. This was hardly not devious. This was a period when industrial property rights was not established globally, much less in China. And these were practices that he deemed actually quite central to building a nativist Chinese industry. So local industry. And this is something that he very much emphasized in his own personal like cultivation of his reputation and the brand of his for his cosmetics as well. So the vernacular, this notion of vernacular very much captures that kind of local nativist sort of element of Chen's practices.
That's so fascinating. I mean, he sounds like this, tell me if I'm wrong, but he sounds like this really kind of flexible, adaptable individual. You describe him as a transitional figure. So both a kind of literary person who's composing works of like fiction, but also these recipes, but then also making things, but then also transitioning between, it sounds like dealing with these foreign imperialists, but then also creating national products for kind of Chinese marketplace. So really sort of playing all sides of every single angle at the same time. Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, it was really possible this time because I think China, as I said, was transitioning from an imperial system, which collapses in 1911, to a new republic. And part of this transition meant that kind of social occupation, formal forms of knowledge, what it meant to be an elite man, what it meant to be a professional, expertise, all of these things were up in the air. So there was a lot of sort of porousness between sort of different fields that we within, from a sort of a contemporary perspective, we might see as quite different. So the production of literature might preclude, for example, somebody today to be a scientist, right? Whose formal occupation or profession might be a scientist. But during this period in the early 20th century, those kind of occupational divisions didn't exist. And it was quite liberating. And that was sort of what characterized this generation who were very well educated, and they were able to, one thing that I was very interested in is actually how they were able to leverage some of their literary skills into success in the commercial world. So to give you a concrete example, what Chen was able to do was he was able to take the proceeds that he used from selling his very sappy, melodramatic romance novels and literally start developing his cosmetic goods and founded his company. But in more abstract ways too, I'm actually very interested in not just the literal sort of financial sort of proceeds that he was able to use from his literary work to build his commercial work, but the skills that he developed as a man of letters, including the act of translation, for example, was very, very crucial for his success in the commercial world. So he was an avid translator. He actually opened a translation bureau and he translated all kinds of things. Detective fiction. He was one of the key translators of Sherlock Holmes into Chinese, but he translated other things, legal tracts, recipes, manufacturing recipes. And these recipes were very, very crucial for him both for the development of his own product, but also for him to share with other would-be manufacturers. And that's what he did. He would translate these recipes and then compile them in how-to columns, and then he would share them widely with this new emerging urban readership. Sorry, you're about to say something?
I was just wondering, yeah. I mean, another maybe in some ways quite different aspect to the story, is there an interesting gender component? I mean, I was just struck by the fact that he was both an author of romance, you described them as sappy romance novels, but then also a producer of cosmetics. So did he understand his market to be gendered?
So it was gendered in an interesting sort of way. So the romance novels were actually read both by men and women. Cosmetics were targeted primarily. Most of the consumers were women. He was also a famous journal editor, and one of the journals that he edited was known as The Women's World, a women's magazine, a genre that was very popular at the time. It was a new genre. It was a genre that was meant to showcase both sort of literary forms that women would read, but also new forms of knowledge. So one of the columns that he featured in this Women's World magazine was how to manufacture cosmetics at home. And it was targeting genteel women who had the leisure time to turn their homes into modern chemistry labs. And he gave them very, very concrete tips on how to make cosmetics in their newfound chemical home chemistry labs. One of the arguments I make, however, is that while the trope of the woman is being used, and he is indeed trying to target a female readership, men as well read these women's magazines. And so the gender kind of plays, it was hardly exclusive. And it was in part because the woman's voice was seen as a very powerful voice at the time to convey new forms of knowledge. So men and women were reading these magazines and consuming this information quite avidly. So one of the arguments I actually make is that would-be manufacturers, including men, read these recipes and oftentimes applied them quite literally, both in their homes, but also outside.
Yeah, amazing. I wanted to ask you about another phrase or set of words that comes up in the book over and over again. So we've been talking about vernacular industrialism, but you also describe Chen as a tinkerer. And then you also use this really interesting, evocative phrase of knowledge work. So I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about both the kind of tinkering aspect of both his literary production, but also the cosmetics empire that he built. And then what it means to describe all of these different kinds of practices as knowledge work.
Okay, yeah. One of the things that I'm very interested in is this notion of tinkering. And I use this in multiple ways. So Chen Diexian, again, as I mentioned earlier, was very adept both in terms of his textual work at not necessarily creating something new. A lot of his literary production was sort of adapting or tinkering pre-existing formulas. So one of his most famous novels that kind of sold like hotcakes in the emerging Shanghai print market at the time was basically a ripoff, an adaptation of one of China's most popular novels from the late imperial period. It's known as The Dream of the Red Chamber. And he basically adapts that novel in order to write his new romance novels. And the adaptation requires kind of a reworking of a formula. So he basically tinkers with an existing successful formula. I see him doing that act of tinkering in the material world as well, right? So he's translating these recipes from abroad. One example is his desire to make his most iconic product, this tooth powder, which can also function as face powder. And as he does with many of his other products, he basically gets a recipe from abroad. Sometimes it's a branded recipe. It's a brand recipe, right? It's a recipe from a famous commodity. And then he translates it into Chinese, takes that recipe, and then adapts it to the local environment, both in the sense of kind of trying to find local ingredients. And for the tooth powder, he found initially that calcium carbonate was very expensive at that time to procure in China, because it was an imported item. And so he wanted to locally source it. Calcium carbonate was a very popular ingredient for cosmetic goods. As the story goes, he basically was writing poetry with a friend of his on the Ningbo, the sort of eastern seaboard of China, and he noticed that the seashore was covered with cuttlefish bones and realized that that's a great source of calcium carbonate. And so he starts to kind of tinker with that. He ultimately fails. It's too labor intensive to really make a tremendous amount of calcium carbonate from the cuttlefish, and then so he uses other chemical means to produce magnesium carbonate. But the story is quite interesting because it showcases sort of the process of manufacturing that he adopts for many objects, not just for his tooth powder. He does this for the fire extinguisher, which is another object that he's very interested in and he seeks to manufacture. He does this for an offset printing press that he does, where he reverse engineers, basically copies a French version, and then tinkers with it and finds a local sort of local materials to make and adjust and basically improve. This notion of improvement is actually very, very crucial in his treatises and writings about how to manufacture things. And so the notion of tinkering is meant to kind of capture how he approaches his innovation. And I use this notion of tinkering because I find it very, very powerful within the historiographical context of understanding industrial development. And I use it in juxtaposition to or in contrast to kind of this previous notion of macro invention, which is very central to sort of your conventional narrative of the Industrial Revolution, right, and the Scientific Revolution, why progress was made and why modernity was achieved uniquely in the West because of macro inventions. I mean, I'm being a little bit crude, but that mm-hmm. narrative actually kind of continues to persist. And instead of saying...
As you mentioned, or the printing press, or... Newton
right, orders. Exactly. Exactly. And certainly others have looked at different ways of thinking of that narrative. George Basala is an early scholar who looks less at these kind of radical changes in industrial and scientific development, but instead looks at incremental evolutionary change. So I'm certainly inspired by that kind of work that wants to look at sort of these sort of micro evolutionary incremental modification that is still the basis of potential innovation. And Chen Dexian is a very powerful, quirky figure that allows us to kind of illuminate how the Chinese were doing that in the early 20th century, and hence allows us to kind of rethink these larger narratives of China being only a copycat nation, kind of always behind the West in its ability to industrialize. I really want to challenge those narratives.
Yeah, and of course, for historians of science, that sort of that older view has been so foundational. I mean, even if you think about someone like Thomas Kuhn and the kind of philosophical views about the structure of scientific revolutions and all that, this is really kind of ingrained almost in the DNA of our discipline. So it's a welcome challenge, Eugenia.
Yeah, and it continues to be made with those of us who are kind of also interested in kind of the global history of science, you included, right? I mean, kind of thinking about not so much kind of a comparative analysis, which still lurks in some of these kind of world history approaches towards, you know, science and industry, but instead to kind of think about the circulation of goods, ideas, the exchange of information that go into processes of you know, innovation and development.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that seems to have been, well, actually, let's talk about that a little bit. So this book very much is a, at least as I read it, is a kind of intervention in the global history of science, but it does all sorts of things in a really interesting way. So there's a couple of things I'd like to talk about. One of them is that it makes this intervention in the global history of science, but from a very local perspective. You call it a global micro history. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by global micro history, and then what prompted your decision to write a kind of global history of science and capitalism, focusing on an individual person, a kind of very specific story, but an individual.
So, you know, it's funny. I mean, I'm kind of trained as a microhistorian. I was at UCLA in the 90s when Carlo Ginzburg wrote The Cheese and the Worms, right? This is the iconic pioneering kind of cultural history, microhistory, right? Where you look at an individual in order to look at much larger structural issues or historiographical issues. So I've always been very, very comfortable with microhistory. My first book also looked at an individual case, an individual woman who assassinated a warlord. And I use that individual microhistorical case to look at larger developments in the rise of an urban public in China and to think about political participation in modern China. And I'm doing a very similar thing with Chen Dexian, who is a very powerful figure precisely because he's so quirky and strange, but to talk about a much larger issue about industrialism and indeed to kind of link it to global issues of industrialization. So Chen obviously is one individual that I then link to a cohort of men and women who navigate this transitional period in China. But I don't want to think about just China. I want to raise questions about Chinese industrialization as seen through Chen within a larger global context. And indeed, it's partially in part because the field itself has now turned to the global history of science and to global history in general. You know, in many ways, this is a very unlikely kind of approach that might seem outdated. People like big history now, they like long durée stuff, you know, environmental history that is, you know, covers a huge swath of time. So in many ways, my intervention is a very odd one. But I want to actually insist on the power of biography, which is actually a traditional genre in historical writing. And it's powerful, or it's a traditional genre precisely because of the kind of compelling storytelling narrative of an individual. And I think that's something we should still kind of hold on to, and it's very valuable. But this is obviously not a traditional biography, right? It's not a hagiographical account. It's not a celebration of the individual. It's not a great man's story. Instead, it's trying to sort of situate this individual within much larger trends that characterized China, but was not specific to China. And in that sense, I do want to see it as a global history. And in the introduction, for example, I liken him to a fellow who you might, as an Americanist, you might be familiar with, Hugo Gernsback, right? Who is this, he was a Lithuanian who came to America and was a science fiction writer. And he was also a editor of radio technology journals. And he catered to a readership of radio tinkerers. And I sort of do a comparison between the two of them in the introduction, not so much to engage in a comparative analysis to compare U.S. development versus Chinese development, but to actually see them as emblematic of a larger global phenomenon. which is namely that the mass production of words that was possible during this time was actually very integrally related to technological development that was occurring within a period where mass industry was evolving. And that was a global phenomenon. But the reason why I find Hugo Gernsback so fascinating and why it was worthwhile for me to kind of look at Hugo Gernsback alongside Chen Diexian was not so much that I wanted to engage in a comparison. I wasn't interested in saying, oh, well, America was at this point and we can see how it was developing through Hugo Gernsback versus what was happening in China. And rather, what I wanted to do was sort of see the two individuals who are so similar in the sense that they were both editors of journals that were promoting tinkering and technological engagement by on the part of their readers. And they themselves were both amateur tinkerers. And they were also very dedicated, both of them, to sort of transmitting knowledge about new forms of technology through the modern forms of media. And I actually see them both as emblematic of a common global, like a moment that spanned the world, that went from the US to China. And that moment is a period where industrialization allowed for the mechanical reproduction of both words and things. And this was something that I was very interested in, is the relationship between kind of the new forms of knowledge work that were emerging globally and the new forms of material work in industry that was also worldwide. So in that sense, the individuals, both Gernsback and Chen Diexian, allow us to kind of look at a global story.
Yeah, it's fascinating. One thing that I really liked about your analysis is that, as you know, and we've talked about, you know, offline many times, much of the recent enthusiasm, certainly among global historians of science for writing a kind of global history of science, has revolved or been written through the idiom and metaphor of circulation. So looking at how ideas circulate, how new inventions circulate, new discoveries, quote unquote, circulate. And looking at circulation, so rather than looking at a specific site of knowledge production, looking at the circulation of knowledge and claiming that circulation is constitutive of knowledge production. Anyway, one thing I really liked about your book is that I'm not sure if you fully intended to do this, but I read you to be sort of shifting the emphasis from circulation to copying, which I love for all sorts of reasons. But one reason is that it kind of materializes the process, right? So as you were just talking about, when you're making radio broadcasts, but even more so in print publications, when Chen Jishen was editing journals or producing sappy romance novels, he was making many, many copies of the same text, but then also, of course, copying other texts and tinkering with them and changing them. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the importance of copying in your understanding of kind of global history, a history of knowledge, and then also sort of talk about the... trying to think about how to put this, but the kind of tension between copying and authenticity, authentication, so that it was really important for Chen Jishen to both make it, to circulate his work in many copies, so to make many cosmetics, many copies of his novels, but then also to promote them as being authentically Chinese.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So you in your question link circulation to copying and how I'm kind of making my focus is actually more on copying than on circulation. But they're also related, right? And so my choice of the word copying or my choice of the theme copying is pretty important insofar as I am very interested in the global circulation of knowledge. But that knowledge as it circulates and transmits, it's not always just direct transmission, right? It's not, and this is again kind of taking challenging previous understandings of how science circulated globally. The traditional kind of narrative is that, you know, science originated in Europe and it just was transmitted to the rest of the world, right? So this kind of direct transmission is what I want to kind of complicate through the practice of copying. And again, a lot of scholars have already sort of looked very innovatively at how knowledge is transmitted and that it's hardly just direct transmission, but there's always adaptation. my angle is from the practice of copying, because Chen Jiexian is actually a big advocate, as I mentioned, of copying, of emulating, of remaking foreign technologies in order to innovate domestically. And this is right a form of import substitution. This was also a challenge to the emerging IP, the industrial property regime that was emerging globally that wanted to focus instead on original creation, right? But for Chen, copying was actually very, very important in order to build nativist industry. And the processes by which copying takes place is what I look at very carefully through his practices of tinkering, right? It was oftentimes where translation would then of a foreign technology would then lead to his adaptation of that particular manufacturing process, which is oftentimes something he had to do. I mean, China was, as I said, very weak. The state sponsorship of industry building was nascent. Ingredients were simply not to be had. So copying was just necessary. And then an adaptation of those copied formulas was absolutely necessary. And as he copied, he found that he innovated. He improved. He claimed that he improved. And part of that was arguably there was improvement it was adaptation that fit the local conditions. Some of that was also marketing. It was a means for him to authenticate the uniqueness of his product, right? And this is something that is necessary in modern capitalism. This is when goods are mass produced, goods especially like cosmetics, right? Where you as the buyer, you don't really sort of see the ingredients. You don't see how lipstick, in this case is necessarily better than lipstick, in this other case. Rather, you depend upon the brand, the reputation of the brand that can be established through advertisements, through trademark usage, and so on and so forth. And so Chen Jiexian was a avid marketer, and he sought to authenticate his good in the sea of commercial goods, in this sort of new urban landscape in China, which was characterized by all sorts of commodities, some counterfeit, some copied, some flawed. And there was a lot of anxiety in China at the time. And this new marketplace was one that was bewildering. And what Chen wanted to do was sort of provide the consumers, his readers, buyers of his goods, with guidance on how to navigate this really unruly marketplace. And he did so in multiple ways. He did so through his how-to writings. Some of these how-to writings, while they shared recipes on how to manufacture soap, they also kind of gave information and guidance to the consumer about how to navigate or how to recognize good quality soap. He was a marketer in his, a literal marketer. His advertising campaigns were very, very savvy. His butterfly brand cosmetics is sort of, a masterclass in how to brand an item. He riffed off of his reputation as a romance novelist. The novels that he wrote were known as Mandarin Duck and Butterfly Fiction. The butterfly was a very popular trope that was supposed to represent and symbolize love. It was also the name of his, cosmetics. It also happened to be his personal name. A name that he chose, Diexian in Chinese means a butterfly immortal. And it was a riff off of a Taoist notion of kind of rejecting man-made norms and having the ability to kind of romantically and idealistically explore new things. And that was the reputation that he wanted to cultivate both for himself and for his brand. So he was a brilliant marketer. And all of this was actually very, very important, he felt, during this era of emerging capitalism in China. Like, how do you distinguish your good vis-a-vis all other goods? And then one final note that I wanted to add is that this was a period, again, of nativist manufacturing. And so what an authentic good was at that time was, according to nativist entrepreneurs like Chen, were Chinese goods, right? These were not enemy goods. These were going to be made in China. And indeed, the brand actually, the butterfly brand in Chinese, the literal Chinese characters meant peerless, and peerless meant peerless. It was meant to kind of bring to mind, to evoke the national products movement, right? So Chen's tooth powder was peerless in terms of its foreign competitors. There was no other foreign competitor as good as Chen's tooth powder, the butterfly brand. And peerless itself actually is a pun, because the Chinese characters for peerless in Mandarin is pronounced one way, and it means peerless, but its homophone in the regional dialect in Shanghaiese was butterfly. So he's quite punny. So all of this is just to sort of say that he found multiple ways. He was a brilliant marketer, and he found multiple ways in order to authenticate what was basically a mass manufactured product.
Yeah, it's amazingly clever. This reminds me of a really fascinating discussion that you have in the conclusion to the book, about where you kind of bring the story into the present day, and you sort of describe these maker spaces, technology fairs, hubs that have become really popular in Western media in the last decade or so, localized in lots of parts of China, but especially, mm-hmm. I guess, associated with Shenzhen in southeastern China.
That's right.
Where there's just all this kind of interesting tinkering and innovation and copying and counterfeiting that's going on around new technologies like cell phones and computers and other things like that. I'm wondering if you want to kind of tell us a little bit about the comparison that you draw between what Chen Dixian was up to in the early 20th century and this more recent history of Shanzhai in more recent Chinese history.
Yeah, so Shanzhai actually is a term that comes, it's a literary term originally, and it refers to these kind of rogue strongholds in Chinese literature where the state couldn't penetrate, right? So there was sort of extrajudicial activity taking place in these rogue strongholds. And this literary term has been used today in China to describe a new phenomenon that is oftentimes found in cities like Shenzhen, a manufacturing hub just near Hong Kong, where a lot of manufacturing takes place by kind of imitating imported foreign technologies, right? So Shanzhai today might be casually translated as a ripoff or a knockoff. It's very prevalent in electronic production, but it can be found in, it's also used to describe, for example, the ripoff Prada bags that are found throughout China and throughout the world, quite frankly. What Shanzhai incorporates is the idea that it's not just a ripoff, but that the local imitators adjust the production to slightly alter the good in order to appeal to the domestic market. Right? So it's very similar to what I saw Chen Dixian doing already in the early 20th century. And as you note, Shanzhai has gotten a lot of international attention. Those who are kind of very invested in upholding kind of conventional notions of IPR criticize the Shanzhai production as just, you know, schlocky counterfeiting, and as an example of how China is not able to innovate. Another example of China sort of, you know, defying the ethical norms of capitalism. That said, more recently, there's been this more romantic depiction of Shanzhai as being quite similar to some of the sort of makers movements and the innovation that you find in startup incubator type communities that might be even associated, for example, with Silicon Valley. Right? And so some journalists have cast Shenzhen and the makers communities there as being kind of the new Silicon Valley. So you've got two extremes, right? And, you know, I don't want to ascribe to either per se. That's not really my goal, but rather what I want to do is to illuminate that there's a longer history of these forms of production. And indeed, I would say it's probably not at all specific to China, in the sense that innovation oftentimes requires adaptation of imitation and then adaptation and then improvement. What I do want to say historically is that this reputation of copying and then tinkering and then possibly improving this kind of these forms of so-called rogue manufacturing that's associated with Shanzhai in the 21st century and that's associated with the vernacular industrialism of the early 20th century that I describe in my book, that they do become associated very much with Chinese manufacturing. So that is the historical point that I want to make. You know, as we well know, China today is sort of seen as the quintessential counterfeiter, right? The quintessential copycat. And indeed, engaging in trade theft and rogue manufacturing, right?
Espionage, right?
I mean, it's at the core of, you know, sort of U.S.-China trade relations today, right? Some of the issues that are... the heart of some of the tensions that are emerging globally today. My goal is not to either, you know, completely condemn copying and say China is unique in this, nor do I want to romanticize copying as sort of, you know, with a neoliberal narrative. I don't want to endorse the neoliberal narrative that might be lurking behind some of the more romantic depictions of makers communities. And I will say it's not just neoliberal. The post-socialist Chinese state is also endorsing, you know, this Shanzhai activity as true mass manufacturing, mass creativity. So I'm certainly very cognizant of both of the various ideological implications. But I am interested again in identifying why this kind of why these practices have been seen as specifically Chinese, both from the early 20th century all the way until the 21st century, two moments when China is really emerging as active participants of global capitalism.
Yeah, specifically seen as specifically Chinese. And then at the same time, I mean, what I like so much about this intervention is that there is this still really widespread notion of capitalism as a not just a space of innovation, but also a space of freedom, right? Where mm-hmm. kind of anything goes so long as it leads to innovative new products. Mm-hmm. And what this kind of emphasis on copying and restrictions on copying, right? Intellectual property mm-hmm. law and other kind of trade regimes shows is that in fact, it's often exactly the opposite, right? Mm-hmm. That capitalism is, you know, global capitalism is a heavily regulated space. And then when there's a player who seemed to be violating some of those, what you just called ethical norms of capitalism, mm-hmm. The World Trade Organization can come down on them with quite a heavy hammer. So anyway, I think maybe if we wanted to use this opportunity, if you wanted to tell us a little, I know your next project is interested in looking at intellectual property law and how it intersects with issues of global capitalism, knowledge transfer, knowledge circulation. If you want to just tell us a little bit about where your thinking is headed in the future around some of these issues and what you're thinking about doing next.
Yeah, great. So yeah, my next book is tentatively titled Making the Chinese Copycat. And so I'll be moving from this kind of global microhistory, where I focus on an individual, to a larger, more global study of sort of international disputes over Chinese copying or alleged Chinese copying. So some of the stuff you've already seen when we co-edited the OSIRIS volume on science and capitalism, where I look at particular trademark infringement cases. Where England, in particular, comes down against China in the early 20th century and accuses Chinese copycats, in particular, of ripping off its trademarks of certain pharmaceutical goods. And I hope to expand that analysis into not just the early 20th century, but into the post 49 period as well. But the themes that I'm interested in are already emerging in this Vernacular Industrialism in China book, which is exactly as you say, it's sort of looking at how capitalism and science movements, right, are predicated ideologically on freedom of movement, on the circulation of ideas, a free marketplace of goods and ideas. And I want to kind of challenge that conceit and look at actual structures of obstruction, even as goods and ideas circulate. You know, capitalist players are very invested in creating institutional obstruction to the circulation of brand names, of knowledge, of technologies. And so industrial property rights is arguably a means by which, various transnational corporations and governments were very invested in kind of making sure that they would claim exclusive ownership over whether it's a recipe, a formula, a trademark, or an invention. And that obstructs the circulation of knowledge about how to produce and manufacture things, how science might circulate, and how goods might circulate. So that's sort of the larger conceptual concern that I'm very interested in looking at. And it, I think, coincides with some of the interests that you have as well, given your interest in the history of capitalism, but also thinking beyond this notion of circulation, which has been a very, very powerful trope, both in the history of science and increasingly in the history of capitalism, and which is a natural, it was a positive step insofar as it was an attempt to kind of think about how science was made in these global exchanges, whether it was in imperialist exchanges or in sort of with functionaries who were go-betweens, who were translators, who would function to exchange knowledge that was and ways of knowing the natural world that then became very, very important to the making of modern science. I think the trope of circulation became a little bit too fluid, and it didn't appreciate some of the obstacles and indeed the politics invested in both promoting the conceit of free circulation with in contrast to the actuality where there was a lot of ownership over ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I often feel like this trope of circulation, it almost like buys into the hype of capitalism, right? Yeah. It's kind of the dream of the capitalist, but in fact, the reality, as you just said, is to build walls absolutely everywhere that the eye can see, because that's where profits are made, is by arresting movement and by arresting the circulation of knowledge.
And, exactly, exactly. And so another central theme that I'm very interested in is precisely, right, I mean, so ownership over things, right, the ability to make a claim and translate that claim, that ability to own something and then translate that into profit is actually a central component of capitalism. So that's another sort of major theme that I'll be exploring.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, I'm always amazed at, like, you know, if you read Marx, like the first chapter of Capital is about the circulation of the commodity, but then the rest of the book is about accumulation. So it's always funny to me that we kind of forget the rest of the story.
The accumulation part, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's where circulation, I think. But I think there's a lot of movement away sort of conceptual movement beyond, sort of trying to move beyond circulation.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, with that, let me just thank you, Eugenia, for joining us and discussing this absolutely fascinating book that you've written.
Thank you so much for having me.